in his quiet voice, it seemed like the universe was playing. Because Baba was sitting there at his chair, going, he was listening to or creating music that wasn't otherwise being produced. And he was tapping his hand and turning it over, and every time Francis would come to a line that would reach its point and make its point, he would look at me and go, is that not incredible? And smile. And at the end, I used the one of perhaps two Hindi words I had learned, which was shabash. I'd learned it up in Kashmir when a traveling circus of gypsies had performed, and to get them to perform again, you'd say bravo, which in Hindi is shabash. And I said shabash, and Baba goes, and he, after that double take, looked at the mandolin and said, you know, what a character. Very good, Hindi, very good. Smiled, just humoring, buttering up for the fatal blows that he knew were later to come. The next thing he did in this jovial mood, Francis actually added one more thing. He read a little poem that he'd written in response to the drug movement that had been increasing in the States and that they had begun to hear about and be informed about through correspondence and articles in Mehrazad. And one line I remember only from this short poem, and it was, don't try to offer me a trip on LSD. I travel unencumbered, guided alone by love, see? And it was beautiful. It was just a very simple sing-song statement about how if you are on solid ground, you don't need to try to shake things up with any kinds of chemicals. It was a very fresh perspective from the Avatar's camp. And Baba said, looked at me and said, God proposes, but man disposes. I think I'd heard this adage or proverb once before in my life, and it didn't sound right. A quick review in my mind made me think that he was saying it backwards. You know, the old saying, man proposes, but God disposes. You know, man makes his plans, but fate, destiny, will have out. And whatever you plan, you know, that's your plan. It's insignificant according to God's plan. Baba was saying, God proposes, but man disposes. And he said it again with a very straight face, and I was not at all sure what he was getting at, and then he broke into a great smile and said, I had proposed to bring you here for just a few minutes and then send you away, but you have disposed of my proposal. I was quite stunned and surprised, and he then gestured to Aloba, who was over here to his right, a bit in the shadows, really keeping quiet by himself, and with a simple gesture, Aloba was able to determine what couplet, what ghazal from Hafiz Baba wanted to have recited in Persian to illustrate some point. And this, many of you who have met Aloba know his great memory for Hafiz ghazals, but added to that was Baba's particular way of simply giving a word or a point which would bring out exactly what Baba wanted to share, wanted to hear. So Aloba recited this Persian ghazal, and then Baba translated through gestures. Erich, sitting beside me, would say, Baba says, millions of men of God stand in a queue, a line, to cross the threshold to the God-men. And out of these millions, one crosses the threshold. That's the first line. The second line, out of millions who cross the threshold, only one can see me as I really am. And then in this concert, concert of time that Baba was playing, going from very light moments and cosmic jokes and appreciating ghazals, he was again very, very serious and saying, you must strive to see me as I really am. And when he would say that, and this happened to be the third time that he said it, it not only became immediately clear to me, stamped indelibly, that that was the theme of that meeting, the theme of my relationship with Baba, the only thing that was important, but he said it in such a way that it was like a mortar shell that just boom, boom. Irretractable, couldn't be argued with, there were no nuances or subtleties to discuss or argue. That was the way it was, and that was his heart's wish for him in me. A few more things were said. Erich indicated that the time of the meeting was drawing to a close. And oddly enough, in my experience, which at that time I was experiencing something a little bit unusual, probably the most unusual thing of the meeting, which was not characterized by anything out of the ordinary. Nothing different from your sitting down and sharing a cup of coffee with a friend. There were no tinglings, there were no lights flashing, there was nothing extraordinary. It was all perfectly human. I omitted one thing that was just slightly extra human at the beginning, and that was when I embraced Baba, I got very close to going over his shoulder, and then in my mind heard a voice that said, stop, you fool. Don't waste this time. Look at him. So I glanced to the left, and his eyes were looking directly into mine, and light was flowing from his eyes with a mischievous twinkle. Just it was a moment. That quick. But then, as I was sitting there toward the very end of this meeting, I felt a little space heater of love, just a wave of love coming across. I say space heater to try to give a sense of what it felt like. There seemed to be just a very gentle, slightly, very mildly tangible sense of a wave of love. At the same time, paradoxically, it seemed to be fountaining from within, a little bubble. I wouldn't exactly say a torrent, just a very soft gurgle. And it was just flipping back and forth in my perception. That's coming from, no, it's, wait a minute. It was difficult to perceive where it was coming from, but there was one thing that wasn't difficult to perceive, and that was that it was love, and a feeling of love coming from him. And as the ending of this meeting approached, what had been anticipated and experienced really, and now is remembered as a dream, came into a different focus. There hadn't been a lot of second guessing of what was going on, but I began to observe Baba looking slightly differently. He seemed to be retracting. He seemed to be coming back down to a frail, small body sitting in this large, overstuffed chair, whereas he had filled the room for the entirety of this meeting. There had been no sense of him as really solid as the body of an older man sitting there. And suddenly something seemed to draw into focus. And it seemed like literally the time that could be for that meeting was running out just like sand through an hourglass. And that it wasn't a whim, and it wasn't an urge. It was simply that the space was there, and the space was coming to a close, and that he was being drawn to work that had to be performed somewhere, some way, otherwise. From time to time, after Baba gestured, his hand would fall to his knee or to the arm of his chair, and his fingers would move very rapidly without any interruption. They'd continue to gesture, and his hands would drop and would continue to gesture, and it added to the sense that he was, in fact, orchestrating the events of the universe. It felt as if you were in the control room of all that was happening. On a very human level, it just simply seemed from the flow of these interchanges that he would not allow a poor dumbfounded seeker to make awkward. He would not allow an interruption to break the flow of exactly what he meant to communicate. While tending to this poor soul, he was simultaneously attending to the universe almost with the back of his hand. But now it appeared that he was going to use the palm of his hand, and that the time for this moment in time in Marizad, in Mandalay Hall, had drawn to a close. And he said, from this receding, the only way I can describe it, the only way I could perceive it, receding relation, this moment in which he seemed to be drawn to other corners, he gestured, the most important thing for you is to hold fast to my Dhamma. And what does holding my Dhamma mean? It means obeying me implicitly, doing exactly what I tell you to do. And then he gestured very, very simply, but in a way that had again the impact of something far different from some kind of sign language. He pointed to himself, and then he made a letter, and then he pointed to himself and he made another letter. He said, I am God, I am truth, I am God, I am truth. And that was the end of that meeting. I arose, went over to embrace him again, kiss him. There were a few moments there, and I walked out of Mandalay Hall, backed out, having toyed with my effort to convince him of my commitment. I felt now that it was certainly unnecessary to do anything except go out with him. It was clear that he was going with me, that he was with me, that it was fruitless to even suggest that I would be willing to do anything else. I had asked him, by the way, among other things that I had discussed with him, I said, you know, I'm going to be in India for nearly a year, and I have several occasions to travel. I would like to use that time solely and completely as you would like me to use it, in the way that would be best to my advantage in learning about you and meeting your lovers. He said, stay in touch with Hoshang Barucha, he's one of my intimate ones, and he will help you arrange these travels. I later discovered, as new vacations came out, as times developed for me to travel and go to a different part of India, that Hoshang would design a schedule and send it to me, and I would travel for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, eventually for 7 weeks in Andhra and the south. I discovered later that before those schedules would be confirmed, Baba would hear them out and he'd make a change. Or in one case, something had been suggested to go to a certain part of northern India, and Baba said, no, not there, somewhere else. That was the only way I ever discovered that he, in fact, was attending to those schedules. He told me that he wanted me to travel to see his Baba lovers throughout India, to see different brands of love for him. And that travel had really created an indelible impression of something that I haven't seen, experienced, or found anyplace else. A kind of love that really characterizes surrender. You see it in the great lovers of Baba, whether in the East or in the West, but you don't see it in torrents so much as you do in places like Hamirpur or Andhra. And I think that it's very important to, if not see it, at least know about it. Know about the kinds of love that people have for Baba there that makes everything in their lives insignificant. From the Western point of view, their lives themselves are insignificant. But these people live with such a joy and such a sense of fulfillment, whether they are completely poverty-stricken, living in the ugliest, dustiest, least productive areas of India, or whether they are wealthy and have more money than almost all of the rest of Indians. The detachment from worldly life that the love that Baba has sparked in them has created is a lesson. Here, especially in the West, it seems that there's a strong sense about responsibility in life, and Baba certainly has encouraged taking the responsibilities of mundane life very seriously, not shirking them, not getting carried away with the examples of musts or saints or yogis or hermits, ascetics, who leave the path and pattern of living in the world in order to pursue their inner spiritual odyssey. He said, be normal and natural, make ends meet, live a life in the world without appearing odd or strange or making a show of your love for me. And that's the paradox that he's created for us, to be on fire with love and yet have our desk covered with papers from the IRS. Yeah. To be desperate in longing for him and yet not fail to provide properly for every stage of health, living, everything that is a responsibility to family, to friends, to work, to oneself. It's a great challenge. It's an enormous paradox, just like all the paradoxes of his saying, a seeker on the path must be simultaneously infinitely patient and infinitely impatient. He says, strive to see me as I really am, yet only my grace can give you that experience. Here he says, live in the world and yet be on fire. Don't be afraid to put your heart in the furnace of love. The one thing that I would like to add, following that description of meeting Baba, is something that I feel fairly strongly about. A couple of recent talks of mine in Northern California have really out of desperation centered on something that's close to my heart, and that is the whole idea of what happens once the avatar has come and established his influence and set his spark in motion. Then how does it get carried on? And it appears to me we all are familiar with the ways in which it gets ritualized and crystallized in the past, and how institutions get built up to preserve this spark of the avatar, to try to carry that impression of his, to cultivate it and to protect it so that not only future generations, but ourselves tomorrow can be refreshed by it. And we laugh a bit and cry a bit about how those messages from previous appearances of the avatar have been deformed and deadened by the very effort to preserve them. And yet it seems an inevitability that any effort to compound and impound this relationship with the avatar is doomed to that institutionalization. What occurred to me once when I had to come up with a title for a talk was that it is very much like the regular army, a conventional army of a nation, versus a guerrilla warfare, a band of guerrillas who feel deeply about some subject, some cause, some issue, and devote themselves to righting a wrong that they perceive, or overthrowing a government, or making a certain point. In a conventional army, people have positions and status and signs of prestige, and they really aren't willing to go out in the battlefield if their uniforms aren't pressed, and they complain if they don't have the latest equipment. Certainly aren't going to risk their neck if they don't have to. After a certain point, they begin looking forward to, how many more years do I have before the pension? Early retirement or late deployment of large groups of people. We can get much more done if we have more people, more funds. Come, let's develop greater instruments for our work. The guerrilla is reminiscent to me of that early band of characters that Baba dragged around with him, bedraggled, forced to put up with the worst circumstances, sometimes introduced at the oddest times to the best circumstances. And they were in it not because they were getting their monthly pay, because they probably weren't in a guerrilla warfare, and they certainly weren't with Baba. They were in it because they had to be in it. There was no choice. There was nothing in the world that they would rather or could face themselves do other than what they were doing. There was no other way that they could spend their lives at that time in history. A guerrilla is desperate. He doesn't make excuses that he can't attain a certain objective, can't go out on a mission because he doesn't have this equipment, or because he's sick, or because he doesn't feel well, or because someone else should do it. He does it because he feels it, he believes it, he must do it. Because he has gotten to the stage of taking his cause seriously and everything else lightly. And Baba once said, you must take God seriously and take life lightly. And I think that if we make any error in trying to maintain a balance between mundane life and our responsibility and desperation within, I think the error should be made in terms of desperation. I would never suggest shirking responsibilities. I think it's the exact most important thing in the West for us to cover. In the Sufi world, the ideal is to become the hidden, the unknown mystic, so that one plies one's trade completely unknown to the rest of the world as a dervish, as a seeker, as a man who, if one forgot for an instant and let one's lips part, the smoke of the burning heart would come out and give away the secret. But at the same time, who is going to be desperate if it isn't you, if it isn't me? Who is going to preserve that one rare link with Baba of the heart if it isn't each one of us, if we leave it to an institution or a center or a group to accomplish? It occurs to me that that business of taking God seriously and taking life lightly has to preoccupy us in such a way that instead of simply becoming a good story about a nice dream, that message, "You should strive to see me as I really am," becomes the axis of the lover's life. I was so taken last night when Adi was describing how important the time of the avatar is. Really, the avatar makes things so much simpler, so much more available, and the chance so much more obvious. And I think that Adi's visit simply makes it all the clearer that money can be lost and gained. The sun can be replaced. One's family, one's job, one's health. But time and the investment in that inner darshan can never be recaptured. And this time will not come round again for a while. And when it does, we'll be in a different place. So that's some of what that theme of the meeting has come to mean to me. And while it's an entirely personal quest for everyone, I simply wanted to share some feeling about longing. You see, after saying you should ignore everything, the path, the planes, and all spiritual experiences, Baba said, "You must long for me with your heart." And it's occurred to me that all the books in the world, all the photographs, a perfect attendance record at whatever meetings and groups, nothing adds up to or equates to longing. And Adi makes it quite clear. Yeah. We're all very simple. We're all very ordinary. If we don't feel desperate longing, we needn't whack off our limbs to remind us of our cause. "Where will you get that longing?" Baba says. "By loving me, and loving me, and loving me. It will come. But until we are consumed by it, I think we should always feel uncomfortable." Jai Baba.
We Indians are known not to keep up to time, because we are always ahead of time or late. And of course, you are having very beautiful, lovely programs indeed. But I got a great satisfaction when I had to come here half an hour late, because I thought to myself that the Western brothers also sometimes do not keep up their time, which the Indians always do. Once I was late in my talk in Ahmednagar by half an hour. So I told them, to justify myself, that Indians are so much infested with the sense of the eternity of time that they don't make any difference between half an hour or 1 hour. Now, today's talk is going to be a sort of a cocktail of things. Because I would say something, there are questions still pending, they are asked. And I like the questions because we can cover so many subjects. And if I were to talk, perhaps one or two or three subjects would be covered. But if the questions are answered, they would really cover the variety of subjects. Now I shall just start with a little preamble. Ishrat-e katra hai darya mein fana ho jana, dard ka had se guzarna hai dawa ho jana. Ishrat-e katra hai darya mein fana ho jana means it is the delight of the drop to go and merge itself into the ocean. That's the ocean of love, Meher Baba. I am a drop, he is the ocean. Suffering at its height becomes the remedy of the sufferer's plight. All of us are so conscious of suffering. All of us want to avoid suffering. And unfortunately, the path which leads to a happiness, unending happiness, is covered over with thorns and a great suffering. That's why the need of the master is there. We have to pass through the suffering. The world has to pass through a certain suffering. And Baba does not create a miracle. He does not change our destiny at all. But all he does is to take our suffering upon himself, to lighten our suffering for individual and for the whole world, so that our path may become easier. It is very easy. All the things, at least my experience has taught me, all things pertaining to spirituality and carrying out of Baba's instructions and orders are most difficult and most easy. If carried out through our sense of love, through our sense of loyalty to him, service and obedience, they become very, very easy. Otherwise, they become most difficult. And wherever the difficulty arises, it really puts all our love, all our obedience to a test. That's why Baba has said, be attached to everything. Apparently attached to everything. This is my surmise, these are not Baba's words. Apparently attached to everything and substantially detached to everything. Or the more positive way is apparently attached to everything and substantially attached to Meher Baba. There are two ways. So if we get really substantially attached to him, then the rest of all attachments fall out like leaves of a dead tree. They don't remain. We have not to exert them to throw them out. Just as I sometimes give an example, that supposing we have to cleanse our mind, it is like a bathroom. It is all covered over with filth and dirt of our actions, the commissions and omissions of our actions, their impressions and so forth. It is to be cleaned. Now there are two ways of cleaning it. We step into the bathroom, pick up particle after particle and throw away. I do not know, a lifetime may not be enough. It will be too long a process. And that is the process I call a negative process. It is not really practical at all. Instead of that, the most positive for a Baba lover, most positive way is to just lift up a bucket of Meher Baba's love and splash it in the bathroom and everything gets washed up. If it comes back again, take another bucket and splash it. If it comes back again, take another bucket and splash it. You go on doing like this, maybe doing once, you may be able to cleanse everything. If you do not cleanse once, you will cleanse the second time, third time, or more number of times. So this is very positive way of doing it. And that is why our attachment, substantial attachment is to him is really needed. Now, I stop at that. This is a small preamble I wanted to present before you. And there is a question that has come up, the question of rituals. What is the difference between a ritual and a non-ritual? It is a very difficult question. It's a very delicate question. That question needs explanations from so many sides. And Baba has really said, Baba has said many things, but he has left them to be worked out by his lovers. And they'll be worked out. It will take some time to be worked out, and a time will come that every discourse of Meher Baba, every thought expressed by him, will take its own shape into a form like a Bible. And that will be created for the following of the entire world. Now for us, well, let us try to understand what is a ritual and what is not a ritual. Baba says that I have come to take away all the ceremonies, I do not want any ceremonies. And people ask questions, performing an aarti is ceremony. If you stand for a prayer, it can be ceremony. Anything can be ceremony and anything cannot be a ceremony. To my view, the marginal line, the line of demarcation between ceremony and no ceremony is, objectively it may be anything. It may be aarti, it may be the waving of lamp, it may be any prayer, recitation of any name of God or Baba. So long we do it with love, pouring our heart into it, it doesn't become a ceremony at all. It only becomes a ceremony. I have to go to attend my office. I am late in rising, early morning, and I have to offer certain prayers. So I just go to Baba's picture, mutter some words, fast, mechanically, just for the matter of finishing up the job and go out. That becomes a ceremony. It should not be so. So the dividing line between ceremony and no ceremony is really difficult to understand, and not difficult to understand both. So anything that you recite or perform or act upon or do with your love in it is not a ceremony. If it is mechanically done with no interest in it for the time being, it becomes a ceremony. What was the other question that was there?
Adi? The first question, there's two questions. First question, is keeping silence on July 10th part of obedience to Baba?
No, let us talk about the ceremony first and finish it. Not jump up to silence.
They want to know if that was a ceremony. That was the point.
Something else was asked by the other...
Duni, I have another question.
No, that the other question we shall take up later on, sir. Let us ask the gentleman of Baba lover who posed this question to me. He has to say something further. Ask.
It concerns the Duni.
Now, aligned with ceremony?
It had to do with the idea of the foresight, the foresight that we can use now, Adi, to prevent things like these annual gatherings, the Duni, any of these things which might become ceremonies or rituals sometime in the future. What can we do to prevent that with foresight?
Everything depends upon the individual as to how it makes use of it. A razor in the hand of a wise man or a sensible man is used for shaving, but a razor in the hand of a monkey, who can guarantee that? I do not know. Who can, sir, vouch for it, and who can guarantee what future is going to bring? I would put it this way, if future is going to make all this turn into ceremonies, then it will be the concern of Baba himself. And if it goes on like this for a few hundred years, and if things go on solidifying themselves into ceremonies, Baba will come back again after 700 years. It reminds me of a, it's a very good couplet. It's a very interesting thing and a very practical one. Andhere mein andhe ko bahut dur ki suji. There was a poet who was sitting there and he composed one line, and he was a very well-known poet. He could not compose another line at all. And he was all the time sitting there repeating the first line. I will explain to you. Andhere mein andhe ko bahut dur ki suji. A blind man, in his blindness, started thinking of very remote and distant things. He could not complete another line. And man was passing by his door, and he said, "Pet mein lagi bhook to tandoor ki suji." He said, "When I am feeling so hungry, my stomach is empty. I want tandoor. Tandoor means a sort of a bread, an Arabic bread which is called tandoor." So, the problem will get solved, sir. It is all right for me to think and devise ways of means, but it all depends upon individuals as to how they make use of a good thing, turn it into bad, or just as a good workman may give good results with bad tools, and a bad workman may not be able to do with good tools. See, this is a practical thing. We have to take a practical view. And if you are not able to solve a problem, then leave it to Meher Baba alone and start doing the things that are of immediate concern. Do you have to say anything further, sir?
No.
Now you bring up your dhuni. Jack?
Okay. I am one of several people who are concerned that the practice of lighting the dhuni fire at events such as this retreat may become yet another dry, lifeless ceremony for those newer Baba lovers who perhaps are not fully aware of its meaning and significance. One may go home with the idea that the dhuni ceremony is one of those situations that should be practiced in small groups whenever the thought occurs to someone. It may eventually come to be understood as an obligatory act. This seems to be a danger of some genuine, this seems to be a danger to genuine surrender of the heart. It is so easy for one to believe that one has surrendered simply by throwing a twig into a monthly fire. Ought we to carry on these practices which Baba...
Yes, yes, I got the question. Now the thing is... Throw the stick in the fire is only... is only symbolic of what he has to do. It doesn't end at throwing the stick into the fire at all. It represents, it symbolizes a certain thing which a man himself has to observe, a certain weakness. Supposing a man is addicted to smoking, on a dhuni day he makes up his mind and go, and here is the stick I have thrown in the fire, that means my habit of smoking, I have burnt it today. That is all. Well, if the man doesn't do it, that is his responsibility. The fact remains that the act of throwing a stick into the fire symbolizes the act which should follow necessarily. It is not only the act of throwing the stick in it at all. It is to be followed by the man who has to do a certain thing. And one at a time, Baba has given the opportunity. Supposing I may have 10 weaknesses, so I am not able to overcome them all. Every year I can just take a stick and symbolize it and give up. But if I do not give it up and only go and stand there near the dhuni and throw the stick in it, nothing is going to happen. Any other question?
Yeah. Is keeping silence on July 10th part of obedience to Baba, or is it up to the individual?
Yes. Now I must tell you this. During his lifetime, the 10th of July, of course, we always observe, and Baba wished it and wanted it. Certain persons who came there, that was Baba's responsibility. I do admit that as an alternative, he asked them to fast when they asked for it. But I'm sure Baba didn't want it. But he was the master, he is the Lord, he can do and undo things. He can say one thing and get another thing done by him. But after he left his body, he has not left instructions that on every 10th of July you must observe silence. But I shall ask you a question. What do we do for Meher Baba? We accept him as the Lord of the universe, as the avatar of the age. Just repeat these words and there it is. And in one year once, can you not observe silence for 24? It gives us its remembrance all day long. It makes us possible to withdraw all our thoughts from, thoughts may go on, but because the activity is not there and we are not able to express our thoughts, it gives us a rest and we feel yourself so much composed and the whole day passes off in the thought of Meher Baba. Shall we not do this once a year? Yes. There may always be difficulties. Everybody had children, everybody has got house. But supposing an accident takes place and one has to go to the hospital, giving up his house and children, what does he do? He has to do it because nature makes him do. Baba is so loving that he never compels you to do anything. So shall I take advantage and not do it? I should do something for him. And I think really that once in every year, everyone must do it. And as an alternative, fast is not it doesn't compensate the act of your silence at all. Further?
You were saying that the writer said the blind man was thinking of things far away. What did the man going, I didn't...
Ah, yes.
What did the man going by the door say?
The man who passed by the door said that he was very hungry. And he said that I want immediate food. You are thinking of some things of such a distance. You being blind, you being ignorant, you do not know, and you think of so remote things when you do not pay attention to that. My stomach is empty, I am hungry and I want food. Can you give me food? That is it. Not that we should not think of distance. We should. But if it is in our power to do so, we can accommodate in our planning to do so. But there are certain things. Meher Baba's things means the whole universe. He is the avatar of the age. We do not know where can we reach. We have every right to think indeed. But when we find, I have thought over this many a times. And I have argued over the subject many a times. And I have seen that there are certain things we have to just surrender to him. You have said it, Baba, you look after it. I will do my best. That is all.
Did Baba consider alcohol to be a drug? And if he did, does it have a different effect on us, say, than psychedelic drugs?
You are talking of alcohol or you are talking of psychedelic drugs?
Alcohol and psychedelic drugs.
There are two different things. Alcohol is different.
Okay, I don't...
Yes, all right, let us talk about alcohol. Baba did not have any objection about alcohol because objectively alcohol is not bad. It is how we make use of alcohol that matters. Supposing there is a man, an ailing man, who needs one peg of Johnny Walker every day, the doctor advises him. That is not allowed at all. Now, these psychedelic drugs are really harmful. Baba has said in that book, A God in Appeal, he said, these drugs are harmful physically, mentally and spiritually. So, under no circumstances they should be taken. At one place Baba has mentioned, if an expert doctor who is well versed in these drugs, for a certain ailment, advises a certain quantity to be taken as a medicine, it could be taken, but it should not be indulged in at all. And they are very harmful. I do not know the details of the psychedelic drugs at all, but this is exactly what Baba meant to say, that they should not be at all indulged in. because they are harmful physically, mentally, and spiritually. Alcohol can become as harmful. Why alcohol? Overeating can become more harmful than a man who takes a peg every day and another man who doesn't touch alcohol. He's a teetotaler. But he go all the time overeats. He reaches harms to himself more than the man who takes one peg of this alcohol every day. So that is it. Alcohol is not bad. Food is not bad. But psychedelic is absolutely different thing. It should not be indulged in it. It's very, very harmful. What was the other question?
Sometimes a person will renounce something and then suddenly they'll start to get elated and start to think of themselves as a great renunciator. Do you have any doubts about this you can tell us about as well? Did you ever experience this yourself as thinking that you were great to follow?
Yes. In our very early years, in order to draw the mandali to him, Baba put forth all sorts of baits and to individuals differently. The bait that was utilized for me was not utilized for somebody else, or maybe it could be, could have been. But according to the necessity, he did that. And he tickled the ego of the man, raised him sky high. I was one of them. When I thought I was the biggest man in the mandali, and the rest of the all mandali are below me, because Baba has loved me so much. When Meher Baba sits with me and gets breakfast for me in Manzil Emim, 1922, before I go to the college, I have a regular breakfast in the morning, early morning, served by Gustaji. And before I go to the college, because I would not be present for lunch, he gives me another breakfast. Masaji, Baba's own uncle, he is asked to prepare special breakfast for me. It is placed there, and Baba with his own hand, morsel after morsel, puts into my mouth. How much tickled I feel that Baba loves me so much. Don't you think that I am the most important mandali member? And that I feel that I am so powerful, I feel that I am so high. But he is Meher Baba, one should know. He knows everything. And in time to come, well, I started feeling myself very great and very high, little realizing that it was the greatness that was given to me by Baba, it was not my own at all. But this realization came to me later, when Baba brought me down and almost crushed under his heels like this and made me feel that my position was this and that the height that I felt, it was given to me by him. It did not belong to me at all, and I must come down and give my wholehearted service to him. And I should not see that my ego, you see, gets so much raised up. So I say, fortunate were the persons whose ego was raised sky high. But more fortunate are the persons who were brought down to almost become the dust of his feet. And those, probably they were not destined for that, or Baba had other more important work, he had no time. That those persons who were raised high and were not brought down are just hanging there, dangling there all the time. They think that they are very great. So ego is such a thing that a man tries to curb it. Once a man tried to overcome his ego, he did to a certain extent. He underwent many self-effacing acts in his life. And then what happened? Tarke khudi se maile pindar ho gaye, azad hote hote giraftar ho gaye. He tried to go in for self-effacement. He succeeded. But then he got into another arrogance, another pride, that I am the man who have renounced my ego. So the very thing he wanted to do it, he did it to a certain extent, he succeeded. And on the other hand, he developed another ego, which was bigger than the first. So better he would have never tried it and had never gotten this bigger ego for himself. So this ego business is at the bottom of everything. And the most mischievous thing, and the thing that really deceives us. And if you really ask me, it is not possible for any human attempt to get over it completely. It is only by the grace and the blessings of the Master that you can get over it, but you have to become deserving to receive that blessings. Now, one poet has so beautifully described as to what this ego is. The first line, as I said, the man tried to annihilate his ego, and he was confronted with arrogance, and he got that pride within him that I have controlled my ego. And instead of becoming free out of it, he got more and more captivated in it. Another way of explaining it is tarke dunya, tarke ukba, tarke maula, tarke tark. Tark means give up. Dunya means the world, physical world. Tarke dunya, tarke ukba. Ukba means all the inner worlds. From one to sixth world. That is called ukba, all put together. One has to renounce the desire of the physical world, renounce the desire of having the happiness of all the inner worlds. Tarke dunya, tarke ukba, tarke maula. And we have to renounce the desire for God realization. And yet that is not enough. Finally, we have to renounce the sense of having renounced all this. So imagine, it is really beyond everyone. And that is why the easier path, the easier solution is placed before you by Baba. He says, you do not think about the ego or no ego at all. Do not bother about it. Just surrender to me. Obey me. Dedicate yourself to me. And I shall do everything for you. But that dedication has to be done wholeheartedly. The least amount of hypocrisy or dishonesty will not work there at all. It will poison the whole act of doing it, and it will not. He will not be successful at all. So one has to just give up, give himself up to him. Means what? Everything I get, everything I have, it is his. Everything he gives me, he gives me. Whatever I suffer, it is his. Whatever happiness I experience, it is his. If I have plenty of money, it is his. If tomorrow I lose everything, it is his. If I have a beautiful wife today, it is his. Tomorrow if she goes away, it is his. Work, it is his doing. If I got a beautiful son today, I am very happy, he gives me. He takes it away, it is his, that's all. This is the detachment here we should have. And this detachment can only be practiced by yourself, by substantially attaching yourself to him. So the rest of the attachments all fall through, and they do not have sway over you at all. Having read all the discourses, having read all the books of Meher Baba, we must come to a certain thing. How shall I be in my life? What shall I do? We should not get lost in that reading at all. First of all, we must try to find out where I am placed in the whole scheme of things. In the entire creation, where am I? And Baba has easily, given it in his God Speaks, where am I? Where does the human form come and all that? And why is there? All the explanations are given to him. And further on, what I have got to do when I have got the human form? And as I said, it's a complete dedication to him.